We're joined in the studio by a man to talk about what is to come, but also to reflect back on the Olympic history. His name is Jules Boykoff. His latest book is called Power Games, Political History of the Olympics. Afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon.
Can we just set you are also a former MLS footballer?
I played in the league before MLS, actually.
Before MLS.
So yeah, that's how old I am.
You don't look that old, so that's why we thought. But obviously, you come to this from a. We're talking about Olympics. We can talk about football. Power games are political history. Now, when people sort of just watch 2 weeks of sport, and as they did 4 years ago, and hopefully they will do in a few weeks' time from Rio, you just look at it and go, "It's great sport. Some fantastic achievements." But there's politics is all pervasive. Sport is not. Devoid of that, and I suppose when it comes to something like a movement like the Olympic movement, politics is the word that you attach to it, because it's political internally, it's affected politically externally. It's giving you a broad canvas for which to paint a picture with your words.
Mm-hmm. Well, I take the approach in thinking about the Olympics that we need not devote ourselves to the death of complexity. We can both appreciate the athletes on one hand and really admire what they do. At the same time, I think it is important to assess the politics of the Olympics, whether it be who becomes the host city, yeah. Whether it be the fact that they walk in behind flags, whether the fact that we play national anthems, we rally nationalist sentiments that can quickly turn into xenophobia if we're not careful. So I take it as an assumption that the Olympics are a political entity. And in fact, I think if we allow ourselves to move away from the strong gravitational pull of Olympic mythology, which entails the idea that politics and sports don't mix, if we allow ourselves to move away from that gravitational pull, that we actually find that the Olympics are much more interesting.
Mm. And have been affected by, you know, political decisions throughout the years. I mean, you know, people will recall what happened in Moscow in 1980. People are old enough with boycotts and then reciprocal boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we from a historical point of view, 1936 was a hugely politically motivated set of games, isn't it?
Absolutely. Those were also known as Hitler's Olympics in 1936 in Berlin. And it's interesting to note that at first, Hitler really wasn't that interested in hosting the Olympic Games, but he was convinced by his propaganda minister Goebbels that this would actually be a really good idea. And at those 1936 Olympics, that's when they started the torch relay, actually, to sort of bring the Olympic torch from Athens all the way to Germany and then around the area as well, as a way of rallying support for the Nazi propaganda. You know, I come to you from the United States, where there was actually a strong boycott movement around the 1936 Olympics. And there are people in the United States, especially from the Jewish communities all around the country, that saw the writing on the wall with Hitler and saw what was coming. But, you know, at the actual Olympics, we saw incredible success from African-American athletes from the United States, especially Jesse Owens in particular, who really laid bare the myth of sort of Aryan supremacy that Hitler was on about.
And yet, really, but at the time, still, America was that hugely divided country when it came to race relations. And you know, whereas Jesse Owens is held up and hailed as this great sort of figure that stood up and cocked a snoop at what was happening within Germany. Back home, he was living in a system which was prejudiced.
That's a really important point to mention. In fact, when he came home, he said he was actually more offended by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the U.S. president, who didn't send him a note of congratulations, than he was by anything that Hitler did when he was in Berlin.
So, I mean, but the politics, has the politics involved with the Olympic Games just expanded over the years?
I think it has, as the games have become more capitalist oriented and we've seen more commercialism enter the games. I think that creates more entry points for thinking about politics. I know when we had the London Olympics here a few years ago, a number of the sponsors came under intense scrutiny. For example, BP, which was a sustainability partner, and a lot of people raised questions about that. So yeah, I think they'll be ever evolving, the politics of the Olympics, but as they become a stronger corporate juggernaut, that has opened up avenues for dissent against the games too.
In regards to moving forward, I mean, let me just talk about Rio this year. There are so many elements of the games that we hope will go successfully, although we already now know that Russian athletes will not be competing, you know, which is a huge, because however many of us will love certain sports that aren't track and field is intrinsically the Olympics, and you know, it is the focal point of the Olympic Games. So this is a huge thing which is which has been decided?
Yes, I would say that the Olympics right now as a general movement are in a slow motion crisis, and it's a crisis on three fronts. I mean, there's the Russian doping that's been in the news recently. There's the fact that there's allegations of bribery around the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, a $2 million bribe there. And then, of course, there's Rio de Janeiro. I had the good fortune of living in Rio as a Fulbright research fellow from August through December 2015, and I saw with my own two eyes a lot that was happening in the city there in terms of evictions. You know, some 77,000 people have been evicted in the city of Rio de Janeiro to make way for the game. 77,000. You're also seeing the militarization of public space. I mean, there was a report recently from Amnesty International that found that one in five homicides in Brazil was carried out by the security forces, by police forces. And so when you hear that there'll be 85,000 members of the security team on hand to police Rio, that's double the number of London, by the way. But when you hear 85,000 will be there, typically some people might feel a little bit of ease, but actually that might be reason for concern, raising a question about who's going to be there to watch the watchers, if you will.
And just in general, Brazilian politics is in a real state.
Oh, yeah. And in a weird kind of way, though, I would say that the Olympics have been a strange, maybe counterintuitive beneficiary to the political and economic mayhem, because typically at this point, you'll recall here just 4 years ago, the media microscope was on every little thing that London organizers were doing inside 2 months of the games. In Rio, that hasn't been the case. I mean, there's obviously bigger, more important, widespread problems that are affecting everyday people in Rio. And so that has really sucked up all the political oxygen in the room and a lot of the media oxygen as well. So perhaps Michel Temer, the new president, temporary president in Brazil, is one beneficiary. But I would say the Rio Olympic organizers are another.
In particular regards to that, then, are you, how optimistic are you or pessimistic are you about where these games, how these games will be perceived, how these games will actually sort of proceed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that on the athletic front, we're going to see amazing stuff. I mean, there's going to be amazing performances across the board in all the sports. Even if the Russian athletes aren't there, it's still going to be remarkable.
In good facilities?
Yeah, well, the only one that there's a question about is the Velodrome, which hasn't been completed yet, and that is kind of scary. And the Cycling Federation, the International Cycling Federation, is quite rightly unhappy about that. But all the other venues are done. So on the athletic front, sure, I think it's going to be okay. And that'll all be televised to the world, and that might be a lot of what everyone around the world sees. But, you know, in terms of other elements, I would say that there's real alarm bells going off, at least in my head. I mean, take, for example, the water situation. And there was a really important study done by Associated Press in July 2015 that found that every single Olympic water venue had incredibly dangerous levels of human sewage in it. And there was a virologist who did this study that found all sorts of viruses related to that. Let's put it this way. If you drank 3 teaspoons of water, you had a 99% chance of catching a virus. And these are in the places where the Olympic events are going to be held. And so we should definitely be concerned in terms of the athlete's safety. But for me, perhaps even more concern is the fact that this was sold to the residents of Rio as a real benefit to them. That, hey, if you host the Olympics by 2016, 80% of the water that enters these areas will be treated. Well, that's not happening. In fact, the state of Rio de Janeiro's governor said when we were living there last fall, oh, we're not going to meet that 2016 deadline. We're going to have to push that deadline for the clean water back to 2035.
Wow.
So this was something that could have actually been a real benefit to everyday people in Rio, but it's just not happening.
No, because that is one of the things that Olympic Games nowadays, modern, you know, in latter years, that the Olympic Games has a benefit for the community. London, the L word, legacy, was, we got to a point where we actually, I think, had to ban the use of the word legacy because it became all pervasive. And this has been trotted out over the last few Olympic Games. What will be the benefit of, you know, there will be a lasting benefit that will happen as a consequence. And then I suppose that gives, the scrutiny comes in, doesn't it? I mean, I've been to Athens. I know that's 12 years on. But, you know, some of the facilities in Athens don't exist or haven't been used. The Olympic Park itself, last time I was there, I know they've had huge financial crisis in Greece. But the Olympic Park itself looked not just shabby. It looked, you know, didn't look as if it had staged a major sporting event within the previous 10, 12 years.
No, that's exactly right.
And this is the downside, isn't it? Because, you know, we get promised, or people get promised so much, but actually what gets delivered afterwards, do they even care?
Well, the people of Rio absolutely care, I can tell you that. I mean, take a look at Athens. It's a really interesting example because, you know, in sports studies and people that think about these big mega events, they call it white elephants when you build a stadium and then, you know, don't use it afterwards. Well, there's a herd of white elephants in Athens and they're not being used. And you know, there's weeds growing in many of them. And, you know, recently refugees were housed in one of these stadiums. And that was one of the best social uses of these stadiums for a long time. Not that that was an ideal situation for the refugees. You know, look at Rio, though. When you're talking legacy in Rio, you're sort of really talking about trying to buy a unicorn with a bucket of Bitcoin. Just because you think it's real doesn't mean it actually is. And these legacy promises made by Rio Mayor Eduardo Paes are just floating off into the ether, and yet he keeps saying them over and over again. Let me give you a specific example. He said, well, I gave you the example of the water, for instance, that was going to be a big thing. Some of the transportation lines that were going to be built aren't even done yet at this point, and they might make them direct lines from Copacabana and Ipanema all the way over to Baja, where a lot of the events will be happening. These were supposed to be legacies left behind for everyday people, and now it's a question of whether it'll even be done for the actual Olympics themselves. The opening date for the metro extension is August 1st, and the Olympics open on the 5th, so there's really no wiggle room for it to go wrong. But legacy, you're right. It's become one of those words that's almost like an empty term these days, kind of like sustainability in some ways around Olympic circles as well.
So has this always been the case since Pierre de Coubertin created the concept for the modern Olympic Games, trying to, you know, have some sort of, I mean, post end of Victorian era, 19th century philanthropy, you know, creating a better world for people who could force their way forward? But has it always been slightly muddied? Have the waters, for use of a pun maybe from the Rio scenario, always been slightly tainted?
Well, I would say that in terms of legacy, it's gotten way out of control in the recent era.
Right.
And with that, you see huge budgets as well. You say at the front end when you're making your bid, oh, it's only going to cost this, when in reality, it's actually going to cost something much bigger. Six times the amount already in Tokyo, they're seeing a six times jump. London here, $3.8 billion, and it was more like $18 billion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's become par for the course. So that's definitely changed since the early days when the plucky Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who you were mentioning, started the Olympics. They were small time back then. I mean, they had to attach themselves onto world's fairs just to stay alive there for a certain period. They really didn't get their footing until 1912 at the Stockholm Games. That kind of solidified them as a world event. So back then, there weren't these huge promises about legacy. That started to come around in the 1930s when they started to build Olympic villages, for example, in Los Angeles. But today, making big promises about legacy, you kind of have to do it to win the Olympics. Unfortunately, a lot of these things, there's no accountability. The International Olympic Committee, they get in their jets, they go to their next place, they're out of there to the next Olympics, and the people of the city are left without much of a legacy, unfortunately.
But with a bill.
But with a bill, absolutely. You know, I mean, debt has become one of the major aspects of hosting the Olympics. I would say that started in 1976, actually, with the Montreal Olympics, where Mayor Jean Drapeau said that it would cost about $125 million to host the Olympics. You want to know how much it costs? $1.5 billion. So $125 million to $1.5 billion. They didn't pay it off for 30 years.
I was going to say, have they not just paid it off, haven't they?
Yeah, in 2006. It took 30 years. And when I say they paid it off, I mean taxpayers in the area paid it off.
Yeah. It always comes down to us actually having to stump up some cash, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So moving forward then, is that going to become an increasing problem for cities that want to stage the games? I mean, as you say, there's, you know, controversy now surrounding the selection of Tokyo. Mm-hmm. But, you know, is it just going to become impossible for cities?
Well, it's interesting because fewer and fewer cities are game for the games, if you will.
Yeah.
And if you look at the bidding on the 2022 Winter Olympics, there are really only three cities in it at the end, and Oslo dropped out, leaving Beijing, China, and Almaty, Kazakhstan. Neither of them exactly known for being thriving democracies, right? So the International Olympic Committee had a tough choice on their hand. They knew they had to pick a host city that didn't chime with the ideas of freedom that are nestled into their Olympic charter. Mm. And if that continues, that pattern, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, is going to be in serious trouble. Right now, there are four cities in contention for the 2024 Olympics, the next summer games after Tokyo.
Yeah.
And that's Rome, Budapest, Paris, and Los Angeles. And if one of those drops out, which might happen if one person's elected in the mayoral election in Rome, who's very against having the Olympics, down to three, and Budapest isn't seen as serious, you're down to two. And all of a sudden, you see that, you know, the field is pretty slim. The flip side of that, that I think could be really interesting, if you have fewer cities who are in the running for hosting, they can gain more leverage over the International Olympic Committee. The only time that really a city has had leverage over the Olympics was 1984, when Los Angeles hosted, because there were really no other serious contenders. For a little while, Tehran, Iran, was saying they might be interested, but they dropped out, leaving only Los Angeles. And at those Olympics, that's the only time when a host city said, you know what, we're not going to sign on the dotted line that says we're responsible for cost overruns. So looking ahead, that could be one of the major levers for change. If it's down to one or two cities in 2024 bidding, they would have really uncommon leverage to demand more of the International Olympic Committee. And let's face it, International Olympic Committee has a lot of money in their budget.
Yeah.
For a nonprofit, they sure are profitable. And they have about $1 billion in reserves right now.
And very powerful as well. These are powerful people, aren't they? We, you know, as you say, power games. I mean, they wield these individuals who make these decisions about where games are hosted, about which sports. I mean, we're going to be talking later in the program about climbing and bouldering here in London, but climbing is a sport which is hoping to be included in Tokyo. They'll find out in August, won't they, I think, with everyone else. But there is such power that these people control, because to bring a new sport into the Olympic Games could have a huge effect on funding nationally and internationally. To take a Games to a city can have a huge impact on what it has to spend, but what it could potentially make. These people wield power.
No, like, you're exactly
right. Like, very important, impressive politicians.
No, no doubt about it. I mean, even from the beginning, when the Baron Pierre de Coubertin started the Olympics, he basically got together a group of counts and princes and barons and dukes to sort of become the International Olympic Committee. To this day, the International Olympic Committee has retained that flavor. There's about 10% or so who are dukes, sheikhs, barons, and that kind of thing. And you're right. They make huge, huge decisions. I mean, we need more women in the International Olympic Committee. We need more athletes. I mean, the International Olympic Committee didn't allow members that were women until 1981. 81, you heard me right. I mean, this is not like a proto-feminist organization here, you know. So we need more women. We need more diversity within the body. We probably need a little bit less of those people wielding power through aristocracy. But yeah, they when they make decisions, it has huge ripple effects in terms of money and power.
And we've talked about the doping in athletics. Can you see more problems before Rio? More countries, more sports? Getting, you know, we know about weightlifting. We know about other sports as well where there are issues.
Well, it's interesting because the World Anti-Doping Agency has been so unpredictable in terms of what they've decided to test and when. And so, you know, typically I would say at this point, no, we're pretty much set, but it's kind of crazy right now. So I wouldn't want to make a prediction on that one. There could be future samples tested from the past that they've kept in hand. And who knows, we might have more people get the boot before these Olympics or have their medals taken away from before.
You said that Rio will still be seen, for those of us from afar who are watching and who don't live there and won't live there, we still may see them as great games because there'll be some great sport, and we all love to see great sport as well. But are we, as sports watchers, do we need to take a greater responsibility for what happens in the host cities and after the games? Is that something that actually globally we need to go, yeah, it's great watching sport, but we need to take a little bit of ownership of what this means for the people?
I do think that we should, and that's where we started in the beginning, was, you know, don't set complexity to the side. Let's just say we can appreciate the athletes and all they've done. At the same time, there's serious questions that we need to ask about the Olympics, where they've been, where they're going, and we need to put pressure on organizations, companies, the IOC itself, that can actually change this machine. Because right now, unfortunately, it's basically a corporate franchise bought with public money, and it is people in the host cities who are suffering the cost. And I think we need to be mindful of those people in the host cities.
And a perusal of your book would give people an insight into what it's like, the machinations of the Olympic movement, I think. Is that fair to say? Is that what you've tried to achieve, I think?
Yeah, that's definitely what I've tried to do, is like look behind the scrim of amazing athletics. I do celebrate a lot of athletes in there. Jim Thorpe from 1912,
yeah,
and on down the line. But at the same time, I try to say, you know, there's a lot more going on here in terms of politics, economics, culture, history of fight back, alternative games I write about in, the,
yes,
in this book
workers
as well.
Games and
workers' games, women's games, this really interesting thing called GANEFO, the Games of the Newly Emerging Forces in the 1960s, hosted by Indonesia, that challenged the Olympic Games as a, quote, openly imperialistic tool, and said that myth about politics and sports not mixing, they had nothing to do with that. And in fact, they embraced the idea that sports were political. So yeah, if you're interested in sort of the secret history of the Olympics, I think you'd probably enjoy Power Games.
Are you heading back to the States in a week or so's time?
That's true. I'm heading back in about a week.